Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and we're continuing our multi-part coverage of legislative action in both states. And we looked at Iowa from both the Republican and Democratic perspectives. Last week, we heard from the Republican side on the Illinois process, legislative session. And today, I'm really happy to have back as my guest, Illinois State Senator Mike Halpin from the Quad City area and Rock Island County. He's going to discuss what happened in Springfield this year. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for the invite. Always happy to be with you and talk about what we're doing down in Springfield.
Yeah, let's look at this from a broader state perspective, and then we can look a little bit about some things directly impacting the Quad City area, which you did some interesting things. Overall, what's your take as you were driving back? I guess from the hard work there at the end of the session, which I know can be really labor intensive. But what were your overall thoughts on successes, maybe some things disappointed, your overall take on it?
Well, you know, the biggest thing that we do every year, of course, is the budget and the supporting bills, you know, revenue and the budget implementation bill. But really, when we head down to Springfield, we often address a lot of other topic areas throughout the spring session. And I think on that front, we passed a lot of good bipartisan bills to solve very specific problems, which I think was very successful and productive. And it's a part of the job I very much enjoy, is working with both Democrats and Republicans to try to get those bills across the finish line. When it came to some of the bigger topics with the budget, with higher education, I was a little less excited about what we were able to achieve. I think it does fall short of what this region in particular here in Western Illinois really needs. You know, that being said, there are great things in the budget that we can talk about. You know, there are great things being done in higher education. So I think at the end of the day, it's a mix, and there's no real satisfaction in a year where there's continued uncertainty. We can talk a little bit more about the budget, but we did the best budget I think we could at the time that we passed it. Now, what the federal government does to affect that, you know, may change things over the next several months. But I appreciate my colleagues that did support the budget. Did their very best under the conditions they were given.
There, I was thinking about that and preparing for our interview. I'm not sure, and I've been around a while, I'm not sure there's been this much uncertainty in putting a budget together in not just Illinois, but all states that can be impacted by actions at the federal level. Can you take us inside a little, some of those actions and the impacts they could have on the budget here in Illinois?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking the same thing. We had obviously the budget impasse a couple of years ago, but that was an internal state issue. We knew we could generally rely on what the federal government was going to be giving us during that time period. It was just the elected officials, you know, before I got there, couldn't get that job done and break that impasse. As we sit here today, it's very much federally driven. And it's, again, not even some of the policy differences that we might have here in Illinois with the current administration, It's just the uncertainty of not knowing what the budget's going to look like. The biggest one, I think, is probably the Medicaid budget, the potential of, you know, thousands or even, you know, tens of thousands of people here in the state to losing their insurance, their health insurance coverage. It is one of the largest parts of our budget. We put a significant amount of money into healthcare coverage, both for state employees and other folks on Medicaid. But if those changes happen, it's, you know, almost impossible for us to backfill that with state dollars. And so we, in this budget that was passed, we try to address some of those things and support safety net hospitals, additional money to emergency rooms where we're uncovered, people will seek treatment. The other big area, of course, is education, whether it's K through 12 education dollars from the federal government, whether it's supporting grants and research grants to University of Illinois, which receives a substantial amount of federal funding. Those things are still up in the air. You look at transportation. Transportation tends to be a very bipartisan and federal-state cooperation issue, but we're not sure exactly what strings will be attached to transportation dollars going forward, which is really disappointing because we've invested so much of our state capital dollars into repairing roads and bridges, and we're actually seeing the results, including all through Western Illinois. So those are just three of the really big issues, and that's doesn't even get into the smaller programs like the farm-to-table food subsidies, SNAP or food stamps, a lot of things that will affect the agricultural industry in our area.
If and I know you probably had discussions with folks on both sides of the aisle, the governor's office and all, but you know, part of this for our listeners is the state and federal governments are on different budget years, where the federal budget starts October 1st. So and the state is June 1st, correct? And so part of it's timing. But I guess my question is will you possibly be called back on like a special session if these cuts are what, you know, we're hearing as draconian as they could be?
It is a possibility. We did build some flexibility into the budget for the governor to try to address funding needs. So on the higher education front, there's a 2% reserve for our universities that can be accessed by the governor if there are cuts to that, those things. There's flexibility within line items for him to do that. But from my perspective, I'd prefer to be called back into session so that the legislature can address the issues. And I think that it's a possibility. I believe many of my colleagues, or most of my colleagues, if not all, are prepared to do that, understanding the situation that we find ourselves in. We did schedule our veto session slightly earlier this year in October. I don't know if that's a result of the DC fiscal year issue, or just a matter of scheduling among the leaders and the membership of the legislature. But we will be prepared to do whatever we need to do to get our job done.
So looking at the budget, I mean, what I've seen and heard some of is the state balanced the budget. There were some revenues that had to be increased. But what especially, give us an overview of the budget, maybe some of the taxes that were increased. But also, I want to get right into education as well, the impact on schools.
Yeah, there was a modest increase in the overall general fund budget. It was around, I think, 4%, which is actually lower than the increase that the Iowa state budget had. And we did not dip into our reserves or rainy day fund the way that Iowa did. Instead, the revenue package that was adopted included closing some corporate tax loopholes. It did increase some taxes and fees on the, you know, that used to be called the sin tax or the vice tax for cigarettes and sports gambling and things like that. But it didn't include any sales tax increases or service taxes or income tax increases. They're very, any increases were on the corporate side or on the, you know, individual choice, individual freedom issue as to whether or not they want to partake in those things. Yeah, it was, there are a lot of good things in the budget. Expansion of the child tax credit, which is a huge benefit to people here in Western Illinois. It also fully funded the evidence-based model for K through 12 education, which is incredibly helpful, has been helpful for the past 8 years to our local districts. So some very good things in the bill. Continued our transportation funding, fixing roads and bridges. You can see it out there on the roads every day. It's a little inconvenient here during the summer, but in the long run, it's all for the best. But at the end of the day, you mentioned education, and that on balance is a reason why I ultimately could not support the budget or the revenue package.
Mm-hmm. So on education, you mentioned the evidence-based funding. Can you, for our listeners who, I know we've talked about this for several years, but maybe it just explain that a little and why that continued increase that the legislature's been able to provide is so important.
Well, the very first year I took office as a state representative, we passed the evidence-based funding formula, which was designed to increase the state contribution to our K through 12 schools. We had gotten to a point where I think less than a third of school funding came from the state government. And what that meant was that areas that had higher property tax value were students in those districts were getting better education, higher quality education than folks in poorer districts. And it's certainly not right. So we passed the formula that would allow districts most in need of additional funding to get that funding first. And we've put $350 million extra above and beyond each prior year to the point where we've put in, I think, close to $3 billion extra since 2017 into our state K through 12 schools. And what we've seen is school districts not needing to raise property taxes in our area. They're able to fully fund their transportation issues. They're able to hire extra counselors, extra teachers at competitive wages and salaries, retain staff, put additional projects, capital projects in place to improve their facilities. And it's really been a huge benefit to many of our local districts.
Let's look at K-12. I know that's an area where, of course, you're chair of the Higher Ed Committee and a lot of institutions of higher education in your district out here. How did our institutions of higher education fare in this budget?
Not as well as they needed to, and that was a huge reason why I couldn't support the budget this year. The basic increase to higher ed was 1% across the board, which is not nearly enough to even keep up with inflation. So many of those increased costs that the universities are going to see over the next year completely eat up that increase. It won't allow them to expand academic supports. It'll make faculty and staff retention and recruitment difficult if they can't offer competitive salaries. It's going to make it difficult for the quality of life that students expect at our universities. It's going to make it difficult to pay for the things that the amenities that students want to see when they come on campus. It's going to be tougher to recruit students, and it's going to be tougher to offer new programs that that students want, even if, for example, as Western Illinois University has done, even if they take those steps of reducing other programs elsewhere that might not be as popular. I'm extremely worried about how the lack of investment is going to affect us, not just this year, but in years going forward.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is a familiar voice in West Central Illinois. He's Mike Halpin, the state senator from the Quad City area on the Illinois side. He's from Rock Island. Our listeners know, I don't have to give a long introduction. He's here today giving a recap of the legislative session. We've been talking about the budget, education, and Mike's reasons for concerns moving forward on education funding and this budget. I want to throw this in here because it's been brought up critically by State Representative Swanson last week, and just the whole legislative process. Now, I worked in Springfield, and I remember this, but the whole budget bill was brought out really late in the session. 13, 1400 pages within a day or two when you got a vote on it. I mean, is this, does this kind of aggravate you? I mean, it, just for the average person, it's like, what? There's no way you can read that. But is this something that can be improved upon, you think, or is this just the way it's going to be?
So I might be a little bit different than some other members in that in February, after the governor's budget address, when he makes his initial proposal, the agencies and the universities, all of the folks that have a section of the budget for their needs and operations, they file a proposed bill based on the governor's proposed budget. And at that time, I actually looked through those to see what the, you know, what the proposals are. And so I familiarized myself with what the budget looks like far in advance of when an ultimate budget bill drops. And so it's a little easier for me when we get to the last week or two of Springfield session and a full budget bill comes in, because I can kind of compare and contrast fairly quickly. But I can see for other members that are focusing on other policy areas, that I can see how it would be frustrating to get it all at once. And it would be great if there were more iterations. I would say this year was particularly difficult because to some extent we had to wait as much to the last minute, so we knew exactly, or as well as we could, what the federal government's outlook was going to be. And we were in a tough position of trying to predict how much of the Republicans' bill was going to stay as it passed the House and is being considered in the Senate. So the uncertainty and the unpredictability led to it in particular this year. Now, if I remember right, last year we had a full, I think from the time the first version dropped last year, it was almost a week, maybe a little bit less. So it was a shorter timetable this year. And we'd love to have it a little more time, but sometimes it's not always possible.
I want to ask a couple more education-related questions before we move back to some district topics that I want to get to. But I know there was a proposal in the governor that the governor came out with that allowed community colleges to award BA degrees. It didn't pass, but can you briefly kind of explain that and maybe your thoughts on it generally?
Of course. And I was a sponsor of that bill, sponsor of the bill on the Senate side, and worked very closely with the governor's office as well as the four-year universities and the community colleges to try to negotiate a bill that everybody could live with. And we ultimately got to that point where the universities had no position, you know, on the bill. They were neutral on the bill, but we just kind of ran out of time with the budget uncertainty and a couple of other issues. I think we struck a pretty good balance in allowing our community colleges to go out and capture students that have interest in those programs, but are otherwise, you know, place bound or unable to attend one of our four-year universities, whether it's childcare issues or just travel transportation issues to get to campus. We struck that balance so that where the community colleges could go after a particular segment of students without interfering with the four-year university pool of students. I think it's an issue that'll come up again in the future. And again, as someone that is very supportive of our regional university, Western Illinois University, I am glad that we're able to really focus that in to make sure that the bill would not have an adverse impact on them.
Brought my students down to the spring session, and we got to visit with you. It's always grateful that you take time out to talk with students from my classes at Monmouth. But I remember that day because it was absolutely packed. But we had heard talk of how the Capitol actually had to shut down because of activists coming in on a homeschooling bill. What's going on with that? And I think homeschooling is taking off a little bit. It's becoming more popular. What exactly brought everybody to Springfield for that?
This is an area where I'm a little bit low on information. We never had a bill in the Senate to address the issue. All of the action on this bill, or inaction, however you look at it, was on the House side. And talking to a couple of folks that were wanted to, constituents that wanted to lobby me on this bill, the idea is to try to provide some sort of framework for registration so that school districts know what kids are in their community that are having a homeschool or an alternative education. The draft that I had looked at, briefly, just to kind of get my bearings on it, was a little bit too restrictive. And I think too burdensome on a lot of families. I do think probably there needs to be some sort of minimal registration again, so that the district is aware. There was an incident several years ago where a child that was allegedly being homeschooled was, was killed in an accident and was not discovered for some time. And that's a failure of the system somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so we need to try to address that without being overly restrictive of families that are taking the opportunity to homeschool their kids.
Let's get back and talk about some things you mentioned at the beginning, some bipartisan initiatives you're proud of, and also some area regional things. I know there's one on mental health you did that really sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, that bill was actually reaffirming or extending a program that was my very first bill that I passed in the House of Representatives back in 2017. And it would allow for folks that have been involuntarily committed because of mental health issues to be treated and housed on the Illinois side of the river, even if they're under an Iowa court order. We were seeing Iowa facilities close and people were being shipped halfway across the state away from family, away from their support network. Now, at least these folks can come over to the Illinois side where they're still close to those networks. So that was a pilot program that I got passed back in 2017. And this year we've extended it. It is now essentially a permanent program, although it does have a sunset date, I think 5 years out in the future, just for review, make sure the program is still working, and hopefully that'll carry on.
The economy, I mean, is still a huge issue, and that's a broad area. But like specific things like reducing costs, inflation is still an issue. People, I hear about it still. Housing is a really big issue. The supply and the affordability. And of course, jobs are always a big issue. What were some things done with an eye towards the local and state economy this session?
So we strengthened our Rivers Edge Redevelopment Zone program. Recently, City of Rock Island, Moline, East Moline were added to that to give here in the Quad Cities extra tools for them to succeed. There were grants for housing development, although I feel I was advocating for additional tax credits or grants for middle-income housing. You mentioned both access or supply and affordability for housing. Those are two very intertwined issues. Because we have such a restrictive supply, it makes the affordability, the cost of all that housing go up. And so I was advocating for a tax credit for workforce housing, that middle income housing that is severely in shortage here, with the idea that we create those units, the middle income residents move into those units, which frees up other stock for people that are currently renting the homes that those folks leave or may have been stuck in because we haven't had an increased supply are now available for low income or moderate income to be able to come in and maybe buy their first house. So I felt that we should have done more on that front, actually, and we still need to do more on that front. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, the budget does fall short when it comes to the housing issue.
I wanted to ask too, we just got a couple minutes left here, but this is a topic that's more of a federal issue. But and it's the topic of tariffs, which under the Trump administration are a major tool he's using. And I know your background, Mike. I know that you're very familiar with this issue going back to when you worked for Lane Evans. You saw the devastation wreaked on Galesburg on the Maytag facility. Yeah. And that was due to global trade. There's a part of I guess, me that's sympathetic to the idea of tariffs to help our homegrown industries. I'll bet you kind of like that a little bit too. I'm just guessing. But you also represent companies like John Deere that are very dependent on global markets. They were in the topic of a Wall Street Journal story recently on the Quad City area and how we've got these dual views of tariffs in the global economy. What are your thoughts on this? Because I know it's a personal issue for you.
Yeah, you know, I've always been critical of these free trade agreements that essentially give up the goal of opening markets. They give up our workers and sacrifice our workers to that by not including labor standards, by not including environmental standards, and just simply relying on cheap labor in other places to make up the difference. I think that when you have an industry that particularly needs protection, I think that tariffs can be a great tool. What I've seen lately, though, has not been that sort of focused effort to really run the economics of a particular industry or a particular material for parts. And the broad-based, you know, percentage tariffs across the board is just as bad as a completely free trade agreement without any tariffs or standards whatsoever. We've seemed to swing from one pendulum end to the other. What we need is something in between that takes into consideration the importance of the American worker without causing a global trade war. And it can be done because it has been done in the past. We need to find that happy middle, and we're not there right now.
I'm always, every year when I interview you, I treat you unfairly and give you a limited amount of time to answer a tough question. But we've got 1 minute here, and as chairman of the Democratic Party in Rock Island County, the approval of National Democrats is down really low. What do they need to do to turn this around? What is I mean, there's a lot of debate at this at the federal level. What's Mike Halpin think?
My opinion is we really need to refocus on the American worker. We are the party that promotes organized labor, promotes health care for all, promotes equal pay, promotes worker safety and regulations. But we've not gone out there and actually messaged on these issues and given the opportunity to vote for bills that support those issues. Other Democrats across the country have failed in that. We need to get back to those roots, make it a priority, because there's no trust. There's a falling trust between the American working man and woman and the Democratic Party. We need to fix it.
I always do that to you, and you always come through brilliantly on your answers and under time. So thank you for that. State Senator Mike Halpin has been my guest today on Heartland Politics, reviewing the legislative session and getting into some other political topics, national issues. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks again for having me, Ron. Have a great day.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.